This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Are we about to close the book on yet another once familiar way of doing business? Witness the demise of the mega CD shop. Remember Tower Records? Lately, video rental stores like Blockbuster are barely hanging on. And will megastore book retailers be far behind? Today, Barnes & Noble goes beyond selling books. It's hoping to literally sell itself. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl, who's on special assignment on this fourth day of August. Thanks for making us a part of your Wednesday. You can almost keep track of who's having, shall we say, technological difficulties by watching share prices. Under intense pressure from Netflix and Redbox, shares of Blockbuster Video are down to 18 cents. Under intense pressure from Amazon and Walmart, stock in Barnes & Noble had steadily plunged this year by almost 40%. Until today, its shares are flying high now since the news it's posted a for sale sign. It's the latest plot twist for a publishing industry that's madly trying to figure out its next chapter. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
A decade ago, Barnes & Noble was worth about $2 billion. Today, it's worth less than half that. Sales and profits have been steadily sliding. Still, analyst Michael Norris wasn't expecting this news.
This whole announcement caught just everyone by surprise.
Norris says Barnes & Noble has made a lot of progress. It expanded into the textbook business, opened an ebook store, and released the Nook, its own ebook reader.
One can't help but be pleased with, you know, how far the company has come in just the last 12 months. So I would have to think that there is some behind-the-scenes shareholder drama that's unfolding.
In fact, Barnes & Noble founder and largest shareholder Leonard Riggio is said to be contemplating a bid. Infighting aside, the company faces concrete challenges. Scott Lubeck is executive director of the Book Industry Study Group. He says Barnes & Noble has to figure out how to get people in the door.
Learn to become much more consumer-focused and looking at new ways to drive value to consumers who come into bookstores.
Industry analyst Michael Norris says big-box bookstores are getting hit by discounters like Target and Walmart, which stock bestsellers, and are finding themselves in a retail no-man's land.
They'll never have the same amount of selection that the Internet has, and they don't always have the kind of personal service that an independent bookstore can offer.
Norris says Barnes & Noble's strong brand and assets could be appealing to potential buyers. But rival Border put itself up for sale 2 years ago and was never able to find a buyer. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Today, for a change, we've been hearing some positive news on the Gulf oil spill. BP says its latest effort to plug the blown-out well, now underway, is looking good. At the same time, government scientists say the oil no longer poses a threat to the Florida Keys or the East Coast. And their new report figures only about a quarter of the spilled oil remains in the Gulf. After a long summer of worst-case scenario fears, the general feeling seems to be maybe things aren't so bad after all. Which made us wonder, really? Marketplace's Chrissy Clark is here with us now with a little reality check on whether the worst is over. Hey, Chrissy.
Hi, Bob.
So the headline sounds downright upbeat in some ways, but you've got some important qualifiers for us?
One thing is that these are estimates, and the government has been a little vague on the details of how they came up with these estimates. So I've talked to scientists who are scrutinizing these numbers. The second thing is that no one really has any idea of what the effect of all of this dispersed oil that they've been talking about will have on the ocean. There's microbes and plankton and stuff at the base of the food chain that really supports marine life, and that's still not going to become clear for years.
Down there in the muck. Huh?
Exactly. And so the third caveat is that the chemical dispersants themselves could still pose risks. That's something that people are still looking at. And then finally, the amount of oil that is still left in the water that hasn't dispersed yet is still five times what the Exxon Valdez spilled 20 years ago. So that had effects for years, and it's likely that this could still.
Okay, that's on the environmental side. What about the people who live there?
Well, that's just it. I talked to a fishing guide in Mobile, Alabama named Chip Dupree and asked him if he was feeling better today given some of this news. And this is what he told me.
This oil spill was every bit as bad as they thought it was going to be. Maybe not in the same way they thought it was going to be, you know, but business down here is just horrible. My telephone hasn't rung for a guide trip in 2 months.
Clearly, he's been directly affected by the oil. Have others been impacted?
Yeah, and we've heard about these ripple effects. Even though there might be less oil washing on the shore now, a lot of the damage has already been done for these folks. We're at the end of the season or nearing it. So people who rented condos or ran marinas or tackle shops or sold gas and potato chips to tourists, all of them have not made a whole lot of money this summer, and that's going to have a lasting impact.
I wonder about the folks who actually work on the oil rigs. Is the worst over for them?
Well, the good news for them is that today Obama said he may be lifting the moratorium on deep water drilling sooner than November. But the problem is that until there's an actual date set for when this moratorium might be lifted, the uncertainty is really hurting the industry. A handful of deep sea oil rigs have actually already left the area and have gone to other countries. They won't be back for at least a few years because that's how the contracts work. And so as long as there's no deep water oil drilling going on in the Gulf, not only does that mean you have workers who don't have jobs or who don't have anything to do, but you also have states holding their breath because a lot of their revenue depends on the taxes and the royalties from deep sea oil drilling. Incidentally, those revenues from deep water oil drilling, a lot of them in the state of Louisiana were intended to rebuild wetlands. So these are kind of ripple effects upon ripple effects here.
Sounds like the water might be the only thing beginning to clear up at this point. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark, thank you.
Thank you.
We're dealing with our own housing bubble. Europe is still coping with the same kind of woes, and now comes the strongest indication yet that the Chinese are bracing for a wild ride. Many experts believe that country is threatened with its own real estate bubble, and it's already bracing for what happens if it pops. What might that mean for the rest of us? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to take a look.
The headlines say it all. On June 11th, the China Daily warned property prices heading for a slump. Prices had risen 50% in some cities. Now they're expected to fall, possibly a lot. Kenneth Rogoff is a Harvard economist.
Probably fall at least 30% by the end of the year, at least in the major cities.
That's about how much housing prices dropped in the U.S. But China has no subprime loans. Most Chinese make down payments of 30 to 50%. Now the government is restricting access to credit in order to let the air out of the bubble slowly. But if China pops its bubble with a huge sneeze, will the rest of the world get a cold? Robert E. Scott of the Economic Policy Institute says not necessarily.
China doesn't have substantial imports. That's really the mechanism through which the rest of the world gets a cold.
Scott says when the U.S. recession hit, our imports dropped and the foreign producers of those products suffered. Still, the global economy would take a hit if China's export machine slowed down. Chinese factories wouldn't need as much oil or iron ore. Commodity prices would fall. That would affect countries like Brazil. They, in turn, would buy less from the U.S. Barry Naughton is a China specialist at USC San Diego.
China is now increasingly part of a chain of transactions. So the knock-on effect from Chinese growth is actually quite large for the United States.
And there would be less tangible effects of a bursting Chinese housing bubble. Many U.S. companies expect most of their future growth to be in China. Their stock could take a hit if investors think the Chinese market is drying up. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Some hints of an improved jobs picture gave Wall Street a rosy outlook today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ah, who doesn't love a ripe rutabaga in the summertime? Is that possible? Okay, the ripest produce of any kind, for that matter, which really speaks to cutting out the middlemen and buying your fruits and veggies straight from the farmer. There's good news out today, if that's your preference. The USDA reports a bumper crop of farmers' markets. They've shot up by 16% in the last year. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill went to find out why.
It's early in the day at a small farmers market in downtown L.A. This is one of more than 6,000 farmers markets in the country. The number's more than doubled in the last decade. Fernanda Torres is selling plums and peaches for $2.50 a pound, more than twice as much as the local grocery.
A lot of customers complain about the price.
Even so, business has been good in spite of the price premium.
At the end of the day, after they try the sample, you know, they fall in love with the fruit because of the taste.
Yaru Baruti's there, picking out plums.
We like to buy locally, so we know where the produce comes from. And also, oftentimes, the produce is organic.
Wayne Howard is the chair of the agribusiness department at Cal Poly.
Are farmers markets really for wealthy urbanites?
I'm afraid that's one way of characterizing it.
Howard says there are markets everywhere, so it's not just city dwellers buying fresh produce. He says a lot of it has to do with food shows on TV. A lot of us want to be chefs, using only the freshest ingredients. And all that demand is good for farmers, who get to cut out the middleman.
I knew a cherry farmer up in Ontario, Canada, who said he sold 5% of his cherry crop through a roadside stand in a local farmer's market, and that accounted for 50% of his total revenue.
Howard says the huge demand for farmers markets does open up the possibility that some people are selling fruits and vegetables they didn't grow. You've got to ask, where'd that tomato come from? I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
By the way, if you think farmers markets are just cool as a cucumber, we'd like your help putting together a slideshow picturing your favorite farmers markets. You can check out the photos so far and offer your own submissions at marketplace.org. There are plenty of new ways to watch video these days, from YouTube on your computer to movies streamed straight to your shiny new iPad. Remember something called television? Actually, that's still the most popular way to watch video. TV reaches 90% of the planet, according to a new global survey out today from the folks at Nielsen. One interesting finding, around 12% either own or intend to buy a new 3D TV set within the next year. Provided, that is, they can afford it. Sally Herships has been looking at whether consumers are really ready to explore this new dimension.
3D TV is here, but it's pricey. New sets start at $1,500 and go all the way to $6,000. And then there are the glasses. Just like at the movies, you'll need special specs to watch. Paul Gagnon works at research firm Display Search.
There are some issues associated with using glasses to view 3D. You know, you don't want to break them. You have to make sure they're recharged. You know, you don't want to lose them.
A lot of 3D sets come with two pairs of glasses. But if you want more, say for your kids, you'll have to pay about $140 a pop. Gagnon says the holy grail of 3D technology, viewing without glasses, won't arrive for about 5 years. For now, he says, consumers will probably put up with them. But there's a bigger issue. There's just not that much to watch. Take movies available on Blu-ray.
There's Monsters vs. Aliens, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs from Sony, and those are really the two big ones that are out right now.
And there's not much TV programming right now either, though that's starting to change. Still, content in three dimensions may not come out fast enough or look good enough to keep consumers interested. Sam Craig teaches marketing at NYU.
It's a classic chicken and egg situation.
Craig says consumers won't buy without content, but producers won't make that content unless consumers buy. He says we've seen this problem before, like when color TV was introduced in the 1950s.
More than $225 million were spent to develop RCA's all-electronic, compatible color television system.
I thought color TV, RCA Victor color TV.
Most people had just bought black and white TVs.
And color technology wasn't yet perfected. Some people looked greenish on screen.
So people were a little bit reluctant to shell out a lot more money for an inferior technology.
And without a platform, broadcasters didn't want to invest in color content. Craig says until the technology got better and prices dropped, color TV didn't catch on. So, will consumers react the same way to 3D TV? To find out, I headed to the 3D aisle of a local Best Buy. There was a nature documentary on.
Yet here in McMurdo Sound, life flourishes.
Sea urchins and red sea stars are shown undulating in sped-up time-lapse. Shopper Mike Gonzalez is impressed, but not that impressed.
Would you buy?
It would have to be really enticing. Like, you know, they give me, an extra TV set for the bathroom or something.
And fellow shopper Fred Jenkins said he's okay with the price of the TVs. But he just bought a new LED display. And besides, there's that whole glasses issue.
Well, I guess just me and my girl will be watching the 3D one. But when company come over there, just have to go in the back to the LED.
Most of the shoppers I talked to were just not willing to fork over that much cash. But industry analyst Paul Gagnon says customers are buying. He says this year, almost 3.5 million 3D TVs will be sold worldwide. And he says prices will come down. By the holidays, sets should be available below $1,000. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, the complicated job of turning sand into oil.
Very basically, they pump steam into the ground, melt the bitumen in place, and pressure it out with natural gas.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street shook off yesterday's funk. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 44 points, 0.4%, to close at 10,680. The NASDAQ lifted 20 points, more than 0.75%, to end at 2303. And the S&P 500 tacked on 6 points, 0.6%, to wrap up trading at 1127. Some positive earnings reports helped drive the upswing. Case in point, shares of online travel agency Priceline soared nearly 22%. That after the company said a jump in travel bookings helped deliver better-than-expected earnings. Whole Foods markets missed the goal, though. Analysts had expected same-store sales to grow by at least 9% last quarter. The actual number was 8.8. Oh, so close. Shares wilted, though. 8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. President Obama visits a Ford manufacturing plant in Chicago. Are consumers spending at the mall? Chain stores release sales figures for July. And the National Conservative Student Conference continues in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal. They say you can't take it with you, and it seems some people are taking that to heart. A few very, very rich people. Today, the Giving Pledge, a charitable organization run by the two richest Americans, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, announced a list of 40 new billionaires who promised to give away more than half their fortunes to charity. Among them, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and media mogul Ted Turner. Also on the list, Alfred E. Mann, net worth $2.2 billion. He's the CEO of Mankind, a diversified biopharmaceutical firm, and he's on the line with us now. Welcome to the program.
How do you do, sir?
Mr. Mann, this Giving Pledge challenge involved giving away at least half your fortune, but you've gone beyond that. You said you intend for at least 90% of your estate to be devoted to philanthropy. Where do you want that money to go?
My estate is primarily to be used for developing medical products to
improve the quality of life and extend life of people.
I understand that you have a special interest in licking diabetes. Why the special interest in that area?
It was an unmet need that I felt was important, and if you look at the world today, the greatest threat to healthcare throughout the world is diabetes. Today, roughly 300 million people with diabetes, and that number is expected to grow at least to almost half a billion people over the next couple of decades.
Now, was this giving away of your fortune something that you were planning before Mr. Gates and Mr. Buffett issued this challenge? And what message would you give other billionaires about why this is a good idea?
Well, first, let me say that I made the decision in 1985 to give away my estate. It's grown substantially since then, and so it's more significant today. Why do I think it's a wise thing to do? I believe that inherited money is not wise. I think it can destroy people when you take away their will to be productive, and so I've taken care of my family in modest ways, and I want to use the money to try to do what I can for civilization.
Now, you say you don't believe in inheritance. I have to ask you, how does your family feel about that?
They've known for the last several decades that this was my intention, and whether they're comfortable with it, I don't know, but they certainly accept it.
Now, do you think this giving pledge approach is going to be a strong force for philanthropy? Do you hope this inspires others?
Well, we hope so. Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett and a number of us have been meeting and talking, hoping to set examples so people will become more oriented and more motivated to give their estates away, hopefully during their lifetimes. It seems to me to make more sense to see the good that you can achieve with your money before you die rather than afterwards.
Alfred E. Mann is the founder of the Alfred E. Mann Foundation and is giving away 90% of his estate to be devoted to philanthropy. Thank you very much for joining us, sir.
You bet.
Let's drill a bit further now into a story we began yesterday about the exploitation of vast oil resources in Canada. It's not actually oil in the ground, but a hydrocarbon known as bitumen. It has to be separated from the oil sands before it's turned into synthetic crude. An estimated 170 billion barrels could be produced up in the northeast corner of Canada's Alberta province. Only Saudi Arabia can top that number. Most of the stuff in Alberta is buried too deep for traditional mining techniques. But as Marketplace's Sean Cole reports, where there's a decent profit margin, there's a way.
There are two industry phrases you need to know off the bat. When you go deep underground to get the bitumen, you're extracting it in situ, which is Latin for in place. The most common method of in situ extraction is steam-assisted gravity drainage, or SAGD.
Oh, you can smell a kind of, like a butane smell almost.
I took a tour of a SAGD operation run by Devon Canada. Very basically, they pump steam into the ground, melt the bitumen in place, and pressure it out with natural gas. Gordon Lynch was the supervisor on duty.
All of our pipes are labeled. That is the lift gas line. The line behind that is steam.
In situ isn't quite as dramatic as mining, and it uses less water. More notably, there are no huge toxic water storage ponds like at the mines. There are also no mines. Everything is happening hundreds of feet down in the earth, so some folks in the industry tout in situ as the cleaner, greener face of the oil sands. But an environmental group in Calgary called the Pembina Institute did a study comparing in situ and mining, and it wasn't favorable. Tara Simmerich is a policy analyst at Pembina.
In situ development on a per-barrel basis is actually more greenhouse gas intensive than mining, produces more sulfur dioxide.
That's because it uses more natural gas than mining, like four times as much. And Pembina says SAGD producers, on average, emit 91 kilograms of CO2 per barrel of oil, which it says is 2.5 times the average emissions for mining.
We know that greenhouse gas emissions is a hot topic.
A huge deal, actually.
A huge deal.
Cal Watson is the GM of Thermal Heavy Oil for Devon Canada. He says emissions at Devon are actually on the low side of the average, 57 kilograms per barrel.
And Devon, as a socially responsible company, we want to see how good we can get.
Thus, Devon is testing out new technology that would lower its CO2 emissions. And it's not the only one. A company called Petrobank has come up with a way to actually burn some of the bitumen underground, which would then melt the rest. The process is called toe-to-heel air injection, or TIE. These people love their acronyms. I first learned about it from Oil Week magazine columnist David Yeager.
So it uses no water, and it uses no natural gas.
Write that guy a huge check. So why aren't...
Well, they are. They're licensing in. It's experimental technology. I mean, then somebody else says, well, you're starting giant fires underground, and you're going to destroy the world. I mean, there's always somebody.
Somebody like Tara Simarich from Pembina, who... Actually, she thinks all of this innovation sounds pretty good, but that it should be spurred on a little more.
The government has to be in a place where they're rewarding innovation. You know, companies should be doing it in order to gain their social license to operate, but their bottom line is really to earn money on their project for their shareholders.
That said, Petrobank has a patent on its new process, so if another company wants to use it, there will be a fee. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention one other thing. 4 days after my visit with Devon, one of its pipes sprung a leak and sent a misty spew of water and bitumen 30 or 40 feet into the air for 36 hours. Most of it landed on site, but a little, just a little, ended up in a local creek, known to the teeny nearby town of Conklin as Monday Creek.
And Monday Creek goes into Sunday Creek.
Nadine Barber is a spokesperson for Devon.
And then Sunday Creek goes into Christina Lake.
Ah.
Christina Lake is where Conklin gets their drinking water.
This seems terrible.
It's an anomaly for Devon. It's an anomaly for the industry. It's certainly not the way we normally operate.
Luckily, no one was injured. Cleanup began as soon as the affected pipes were shut off. Devon lost 1/7 of its daily production, and the leak gave critics of the oil sands more fodder for their case. Still, oil companies wouldn't be mining and in-situing the oil sands if we weren't demanding so much fuel from them. The International Energy Agency says oil demand could go up 40% worldwide over the next 20 years. If they're right, then it's going to come from somewhere. And those of us who drive cars and take planes should at least know where that is. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
If you want to see those oil sands for yourself, there's a slideshow on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, just in case this news flew right by you as it did us, the CEO of Spirit Airlines let it drop during an interview with ABC News. The charging for carry-on bags probably isn't the end of the carrier's creative ways to squeeze money out of customers. How about a charge for talking to a human at the airport? Spirit Chief Ben Baldanza says someday the airline might consider a fee for getting help from one of its employees. Look on the bright side, though. He says it won't happen right away, at least not till the company's better equipped to have you deal with a machine. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 44 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ lifted 20 points, almost 1%. The S&P 500 gained 6 points, 0.6%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, does that sustainable label on your albacore really mean anything?
Everyone claims they're fishing sustainably, but you really can't know without a thorough scientific assessment whether it truly is.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.